I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
They swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
right. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello. Welcome back to Stages. I'm Peter Ayers. Continuing the series of conversations I recently recorded in the US, it's a treat to say hello again to Barry Creighton. Barry recorded a double episode in May 2020 for the Stages podcast via Zoom at the beginning of the COVID crisis. This time we were able to sit together at his home in Los Angeles, a chance to see what's been happening since 2020, especially on the writing front, where Barry has been prolific with several very successful novels. Barry's stage, screen and radio credits are extensive, and I encourage you to examine his stellar resume in the socials that accompany this episode. Barry is much missed from these shores, and I know you're going to be thrilled by hearing the dulcet tones and inimitable wit of Barry Creighton in this special episode of the Stages podcast. Oh, Barry Creighton, it's lovely to be back in your home.
Well, it's nice to have you here in my home.
You were on the podcast featured in 2020, so that's quite a while.
Is that pre-COVID, yes?
Yeah.
Everything's pre or after, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a PC.
Yeah, PC.
So thank you for having a chat again. We covered a lot of your tremendous career in that double episode podcast, and I think... We finished with you living in Los Angeles, this wonderful movie industry town.
This fictitious town.
Of Hollywood.
Yes.
How did you get here?
Well, we were living in New York. I was there for 3 years. And my play Double Act had been bought to be produced in New York. Then the money dwindled a little. It was becoming a little tough. My partner, Vaughan, had run out of theatre things, and he was doing television design at that time, and he was offered a job out here, and I had written a screenplay which was bought by Hearst Television in Los Angeles, so we thought we'll come out for a couple of months and try it out. Kept our apartment in New York, came out here, and we stayed at first in Tony Lamont's house in Hollywood. She was out of touch, she was in Australia at the time, of course, and we spent 9 months there. Our 2 months turned into 9 months. And suddenly we realized we were living in Los Angeles. My deal with Hearst Television was going ahead. Vaughan was offered work here in television design. And we realized we had to give up the apartment in New York. We couldn't keep two apartments going. So we found a house here, gave up the apartment in New York, and suddenly we're living in Los Angeles. It took me 5 years to get used to this town. After New York, I hated LA. And then I went back to Australia. No, I went back to New York to do a review. And it was a very acrimonious rehearsal process in which Elaine Stritch figured very unpleasantly. And I realized during that the months I spent back in New York on rehearsing that review I wrote, that I missed Los Angeles, of all places. I couldn't wait to get back here. It's a very hard place to get used to, but once you do, it's a very hard place to leave LA.
You're such a creature of the theatre. LA, one would assume there is a dearth of theatre.
It's
how did you cope?
LA theatre is a contradiction in terms, I've always said. it's the poor relation here. This is a movie town. And unlike London, where you have theatre and movies coming out of the same city, they're all centred in London, so actors do both. Here, you have movies on this coast, and 3,000 miles away, you have theatre. It's a very tough attitude here, because people in the movie business always think you only do theatre because you can't get into the movies. That's the attitude here. I remember Alfred Molina, when he first came to LA, was waiting for, there were months before he did his first movie project, whatever it was, and he said to his agent, I think while I'm waiting, I'd probably do a play. I could go back and do some theatre somewhere. And his agent, good God, no. He said, you don't want people to think you're out of work, do you? That was the attitude to it. And it's never really changed. For all of that, I found a little theatre company which has had a lot of prestige going for it. And most of the deals I've done here associated with theatre have worked out to my advantage. There was a very well-known and regarded company called LA Theatre Works, who have major stars doing audio productions, and I began working for them, adapting and directing for them, and occasionally playing in things they'd done. One of the ones I played in, I remember the cast of Tribes, which is a wonderful play which played off Broadway for a year in New York and in London. They brought the entire cast from New York to do the audio production here in front of a live audience, 5 performances, then it's edited and put onto CDs and broadcast all over the world. And they lost their leading man. So they asked me to take over the part opposite Mayor Winningham, who's a wonderful actress. And it was terrific. And I remember calling Vaughan, my partner, to tell him about the job. And he said, what's the character? And I said, it's an aging curmudgeon. He said, dear God, will you be able to get anywhere near it?
Did you want to pursue the path of actor once you were here in Hollywood?
Not really. I did a few projects for some of the theatres here, the smaller theatres. I did Cousin Bet, playing a lead in that. I played Apollo in Oedipus Rex. I said it was typecasting, of course. I've done a few things. I've acted for LA Theatre Works. I've done acting work for them as well, but very little. I came really round to write. Well, the joy of being here in the early years I was in LA was that I kept going back to Sydney to do plays. John Crummell called me up from Marion Street one day and said, here are the dates, write something. So I wrote Valentine's Day, which has played well there and has since been done in many languages. Again, he called me up and said, write something, here are the dates, and it was Later Than Spring, which is now being translated for Germany. And The Ensemble, of course, I went back there to do duets with Noeline Brown, and also the Florence Foster Jenkins play, Glorious, which I love doing. But it's sort of petered out, and I'm getting on a bit. And writing has always been a passion of mine. I mean, I've been doing that for most of my acting career, and that's taken over now. It's all I do.
You're a terrific entertainment historian. I learn so much by being in your company every time.
It's because I never stop talking.
I visit. But you obviously grew up with the flicks, did you? Movies
yes,
were a passion.
Yes, you bet.
Yeah.
As a kid, I never knew there was, in Brisbane in the 50s, I never knew there was a theatre movement at all, because my parents were not interested in theatre in the slightest. So I had to find that out in my mid-teens. But yes, I went to the movies as often as I could and was fascinated not only by the movies, but by the technique of making movies, and also the mechanics of making movies. I mean, how projectors work, how fast film has to go, what lighting is needed. All of that fascinated me from a very, very early age, and it still does. My passion, you've seen the collection of movies I've got, and a lot of them are silent, some of them going back to the teens of the 20th century, just because I want to see the technique they used in those days. That's always been a passion. Theatre as well. Theatre took over when I was in my mid-teens, when I discovered there were theatre groups in Brisbane, and it never let go. Actually, after that, I was hooked.
But living in LA must have been quite exciting, because you could go and visit those sites where great westerns were filmed.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Vaughan Edwards, my partner, is a production designer for some major television things here. He's very well regarded in this town. And thanks to him, and this was pre-security is now a big problem, getting onto any studio lot. But in the days, he was working at Universal on a series, I would go collect him. Sometimes we'd have a walk around the back lot, see the Psycho House, the Bates Motel, the Western Street, the Paris Street, all of those things, which they still have. Sadly, MGM tore up their back lot and sold it. So did 20th Century Fox. So they didn't do what Universal did and make a theme park out of it. Warner's still has a lot here, which is pretty extravagant, a back lot. Some of those studios are amazing. And Paramount, he worked at Paramount. And I remember going there to have lunch with him often while he was at Paramount and going past the stages where they have signs on the doors telling what movies were made there. And you see there's Studio 18 where they did the scene with Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard. All of those things are listed on the doors, which is fascinating for the history, if you like movie history at all.
Oh, one of the joys of driving around with you is pointing that way, looking at that park, and have a look at that stairwell, you know, because...
But it's a passion for history. I did that when I was in New York as well. Anyone came to visit from London or Australia, I would tour New York. I would walk my feet off pointing at historic sites. Where Macy's is now, for instance, there's a plaque on the wall. Thank God they put one there. To say, here the motion picture began. This is where the first movie was ever shown in the world, at Costa and Biles Music Hall, which is now where Macy stands. Little things like that are fascinating to me.
Last night we dined at Musso and Frank's,
yes,
which is a Hollywood institution, one of my favourite places to visit when I'm in LA, which you introduced me to several years ago. 1919.
It's been there since 1919, which we could still get a steak for like 50 cents or something. They built an extension onto it where we ate last night in 1953, I think he said. But it's traditional Hollywood. It's old Hollywood. There are red leather booths inside. It's dark. And the waiters, they're much younger, I've got to say, these days. They used to be very old because I think some of them had been there since the foundation stone was laid. And very crusty, all of them. Very precise about what you say and what they respond to. But it's a wonderful place to eat because of the history.
Any listener that is a fan of the Kaminsky method would recognize the place as the restaurant where Michael Douglas would meet his agent regularly for discussions. Where else in Hollywood would you recommend a tourist seek out?
I would certainly say the Griffith Observatory, because that's where they shot the final scenes of Rebel Without a Cause. Also because it's a great building and now it's a museum.
But that park there, that was a location for a lot of Westerns and the Batman
Griffith Park,
TV series.
Griffith Park is an enormous park, bequeathed to the city by J.J. Griffith, who was a financier, and way back at the turn of the 20th century. And there's this wonderful thing that somebody said during the making of a silent movie, early in the silent days in L.A., when this director said, we're doing everything in a studio, you know, fake trees, fake backdrops. Why don't I go out into the open air, go to the country and shoot, a Western in the real Arizona? And the producer said, a tree's a tree, shoot it in Griffith Park. So, yeah, Griffith Park, certainly. Where else?
There's the Disney Music Hall.
I think during COVID it's the one venue that I missed more than any. The Disney Concert Hall is a remarkable building. The architecture by Gehry is extraordinary. There's not a right angle in the entire building, but it is one of the best concert halls in the country, acoustically, which they designed it for. It's remarkable. And we have one of the best orchestras in the country here. The LA Philharmonic is incredible. So yes, that's a venue that I'm at regularly these days because I'm passionate about music, of course. And that's the one I missed most during lockdown. Yeah. Theatre, no.
We were on Hollywood Boulevard last night.
We were.
There's some terrific old cinemas which are still in working order there.
Unlike Australia, where they keep tearing theatres down.
Yeah.
This is a big thing of mine. Here in LA, they're preserving old theatres. And now that downtown has become a place again, because for many years it was dark. But once they introduced the metro system, downtown came to life. And they've restored so many of the old theatres there. The United Artists Theatre, which is a Gothic wonder, was built by Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford and had the United Artists seal on it. The Orpheum, the Palace Theatre, where Sarah Bernhardt once played, and the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields played there. They've all been restored wonderfully. They do live music there. Sometimes they have retrospective movie showings or stage shows, but they're there. and they're in pristine condition. The Los Angeles Theatre is so grand, the lobby of it has been shot for the Vatican. Because it's got so much gilt and so many chandeliers and everything. That's a joy to know that that old theatres are being preserved.
Yeah.
And I'm a member of the LA Conservancy as well, so I contribute to their restoration, I'm happy to say.
And, of course, wonderful new theatres like the Dolby, where the Academy Awards...
Yes, it's a barn. It's enormous. It holds tens of thousands of people, and you could... You know, sometimes you have to... You wonder where the voices are coming from the stage. It's so far away. And the Pantages, similarly. But the Pantages was built as a movie theatre, and it's doing the touring shows now. The big musicals go there. But that was restored by Disney at a cost of millions and is a remarkable theatre. It's more gilt than I've ever seen, you know, outside of the Vatican, actually.
And LA boasts some wonderful museums, too, and galleries. I mean, the Getty is a must-see.
The Getty is a must-see, certainly. The new Motion Picture Museum is wonderful as well. Great exhibitions, a good theatre. That's very new. That only opened, you know, 6 months ago. That's terrific. The Modern Art Museum, the LA County Museum, is what there's a lot of good stuff here. The city is so spread out, though. Real estate was easy to come by in the 20s, so people bought farther and farther out. It's hell getting around these days, as you know, on a freeway. You take hours to get anywhere.
Yeah. Tell me about the LA River, because that's something I learned yesterday, too. I hadn't realized that iconic set, which is in a lot of action films, and certainly I think Grease, the musical, they have a car chase there, is actually a river.
It's a river. They've lined it all with concrete, of course, because there's hardly ever water in it. So they can do chases down there and car chases. And I think To Live and Die in L.A., the Friedkin picture, they shot a final scene in there. But we had a flash flood a couple of weeks ago, and so there was water in it, which was a shock to everybody.
Barry, through these chats, we can do 6 degrees of separation. And I can access some people who are no longer with us. And I wonder if we could spend a few moments just remembering a few people that we've lost in the last 1 or 2 years. And I'm first of all, think of Carol Cook, who was a great friend of yours.
Yes.
Carol Cook was in Australia as Dolly Levi in that original J.C. Williamson's production.
She's probably the best Dolly I've ever seen in my life. I think I've seen a bunch of productions of Dolly over the years. That was about 67 or 68, I think. And I first met her there. I saw the show twice. I loved it so much, and I loved her. And we renewed our friendship here once I came to live in L.A. And she and her husband are terrific people. Carol only died last year at 99, on the edge of 99. But she was still doing cabaret at 95. We saw her doing a show, doing songs and the dirtiest jokes I've ever heard in my life. But she was one of the wittiest women I've ever met in my life as well. She... made headlines when she was caught in a restaurant during the Trump presidency. And a reporter nabbed her and said, "How do you feel about President Trump?" And she said, "Where is John Wilkes Booth when you really need him?"
I remember that.
And it made the papers all over the country. I thought it was very funny. The next day, the FBI was on her doorstep and questioned her for 2 hours. She used to close they had a big AIDS benefit here every year. Major stars, movie stars, New York Broadway stars, would come to do this benefit every year, and she closed the show every year with a routine. She came up on the lift out of the orchestra pit at one finale in a great red cloak and 3 chorus boys on either side of her. And she said, "Do you like this cloak? It was a gift from my personal friend, the Pope." And these guys are 3 altar boys he wasn't using this week. She was a very funny woman, very funny. She also said she was frisked once at an airport, and she said, "Do you really think a terrorist would have hair this colour?" Because her hair was always bright, bright red.
I remember a number she did, Strike Up the Band.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one? She walked out, she let the drums roll out, and then this bass drum would roll out
off the stage. Yes.
Until she got to Strike Up the Band, and the whole orchestra had liners in the air.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful.
A colleague of many years of yours through the Mavis Branton show and Blankety Blanks, and of course touring with that great Michael Frayn farce, Noises Off, was Carol Rae.
Yes, yeah. Sadly missed. Carol and I were in touch frequently. I mean, Carol, we became family during Branston. We remained so for the whole of her life. she came to stay with us for a couple of weeks, 20 some years ago, and walked us off our feet. We did all the tourist things for her as well. But Carol was a great talent, of course, and has the distinction of being the first female television executive in the country, in Australia. She really turned the table for everybody. She turned the whole thing around. But it's thanks to her that Bramston happened, and thanks to her, really, that I moved from theatre into television doing that. I remember the week it happened vividly. I was doing my thing at the Music Hall Theatre in Sydney, where I had an established audience. And during the week, I know people said there were executives from Channel 7 in the audience. And one night, I heard Gordon Chater's loud guffaw in the theatre, and there's this glamorous woman with him, and I found out later it was Carol Rae. The next day, they offered me the pilot of the Ramsden show, outright. I didn't have to audition or anything. They just said, will you do the pilot? And it meant leaving the Music Hall, which I thought, this is a comfortable income and an established thing. And I thought, maybe this show will never work, because it was going to be very brave, I thought. And I left. I did the pilot, and history, you know, was made. Carol was the instigator of that. She was responsible for the entire thing happening. And remained family for the whole since we've known each other.
She was a great stage actress also, as I yep. talked about Noises Off and David Williamson's Travelling North.
Yes, of course.
What would she like to act against on stage in front of an audience?
Well, we came to know each other better when we did the Mike Walsh show for 2 years.
Lots of sketches.
I wrote sketches for that. I wrote maybe 40 each, both 2 years, every week. And Carol and I knew each other so well, I would send her the script. We'd meet in the studio on a Monday morning, we'd rehearse for an hour, then we'd do it live. And we knew each other so well that we could ad-lib, we could do whatever we liked within the sketch, and it still worked because we had a wonderful rapport. The only other person I've ever had that kind of rapport with is Nolene. Yeah. You know, we understand each other's timing, each other's wit. The only time Carol and I ever fell out about anything was our politics differed. Carol was rather to the right and mine are extremely to the left. And whenever I did something criticising the right wing in Australia, Carol would object to it. So we had to get over that hurdle with every sketch. But like all families, we were closer than close, you know.
There's a great documentary out at the moment, isn't there, on the Mavis Brandt?
A terrific documentary. It's called Pushing the Boundaries. It was made by Stefan Welling, who does major documentaries about wonderful people. He did a wonderful one about Rod Taylor. Ida Lupino, he's done one. He's doing one now about Tommy Tico. But that happened, that documentary happened, because Stefan was visiting L.A., and I lamented to him. We talked about the Bramston show. I said, it's the 50th anniversary, and Channel 7 hasn't done anything to mark the occasion. And he thought about this for about a week and said, I'm going to do a documentary about it. And it took him 10 years to get Channel 7 to cough up
the material.
I can't understand why it was the show that the greatest hit they've ever had. Yeah. But he finally got it together. It's a great documentary. And if you have the chance to see it, anyone should see it. It's terrific.
And of course, John Sentchuk has a terrific biography of Carol Rae.
Yes, he does. I did the foreword in this year.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Great. The great Barry Humphries we lost towards the end of last year.
He did. What a genius. My God. Nobody was greater than he was in Australia. I knew him in the Bramston years. My first encounter with Barry was when I had my own radio show when I was 20 in Brisbane on a Sunday night. It was all about theatre. Television hadn't quite happened at that time. So theatre was still an event. And I had the very first 45 RPM disc he ever made called Wildlife in Suburbia, which was very bold for those days, and I played it in my program. I told him about this many years later, and he was very flattered that I should have known him so soon. But then in 1965, he did a guest appearance on Bramston, a very early incarnation of Edna. But I've known him ever since then. He was wonderful. He was great. One experience I remember in particular, I was touring Australia with a play called Bedroom Farce by Alan Ayckbourn. And we played Perth, and Barry was following our show in with his in Perth. So he came to see Bedroom Farce, and I stayed on so that I could see his. But in the interim, we had lunch one day, and at the restaurant, on the menu, it said Dufish, D-H-U-F-I-S-H. And he called the maitre d' over and he said, is this a polite way of saying Jewfish? And the maitre d' said, I imagine it is, yes. So when I went to see his show, he had a succession of news slides at the intermission, and one of them said, Dewfish jumps over Diumbo Diet. He never wasted any material at all.
Tell us about the telephone that was on high.
Oh, yeah. During one of his shows at the Old Her Majesty's, which I think is gone now, hasn't it, in Brisbane, in Sydney?
Down in...
Okay. Yeah. It was brick interior, as I remember, rather a plain interior. Yeah. And one of his shows, we came in, sat in the audience, and way up high, like 50 feet high, is a telephone stuck on the wall. And you think, how is this practical, this telephone? Anyway, you forget about it. He did the entire show. We applauded. We're leaving the theatre. And the telephone rang 50 feet up on the way. It just kept ringing until the audience had left the theatre. That was a great joke.
Dadaism.
Yes, really, really.
bedroom farce, of course, it brings up one of my favourite genres of the theatre, which is farce.
Yes.
Of course, you did explore that Noises Off.
I did.
And you've written farces as well.
I have. I wrote a farce in London under the auspices of Ray Cooney, who was the great farcer in London. I mean, his farces are still done everywhere. And he commissioned this from me. I wrote a farce during my poverty-stricken period in London. It was something for me to do to keep the brain working. But it had a cast of 15 people, and it was the three-day working week in England where businesses were going under. And Ray said, I don't want to do this one because the cast is too big. Write one of the smaller cast. And we discussed it for quite some time. I was doing a summer season at Eastbourne. I remember I had notepads with me on the beach every day, you know, writing stuff. And we opened at Westcliff, and it was very successful there. It needed work, but because of the three-day working week, we forgot about coming into the West End. But it was a great exercise for me. I love farce, of course, and we had good people playing it. And that was a terrific... It was called Follow That Husband. That's a great title for a farce.
Absolutely. What are the conventions of farce? What's important for the actors to know?
I've told you, I've told everybody this story. Ray Cooney's description of what a farce is about, how a farce works, is the scene is a mansion, and there are two slightly suspicious people, the protagonist, who are forming a plot. And when this man called Mr. Carlos arrives, the whole plot suddenly goes into gear, goes into action, and the dastardly plot starts. So they're running around the house waiting for Mr. Carlos to arrive, and there's a ring at the door, and the butler goes to answer the door, and this man says, I'm terribly sorry, but may I use your telephone? My car has broken down. And one of the protagonists rushes by and says, are you Carlos? And he says, yes, I am. And suddenly he's involved in the plot, which is the point of all farce, a mistaken identity.
Yeah, yeah. And so it begins.
Yeah.
One of the finest farces ever written was Michael Frayn's Noises Off.
Well, it's a view of farce. It's a comment on farce as well as being a farce. It's one of the funniest plays ever written, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, you were part of that, playing Frederick Fellows in the Australian production, and led by the most glorious, wonderful director, Michael.
Oh God, I'll never work with a greater director. He died sadly recently. Yeah. We became good friends because I worked with him in London as well on Don's Party at the Royal Court, and we became friends then. And I saw him whenever he was in Australia when I came back in the '80s, and. I don't think I'll ever work with a director as great as he is again. He understood actors very well. He understood what the play had to look like at the end result, but he was always open to suggestion and willing to listen to something that you had to offer. For instance, in the very first act of Noises Off, my character, Freddie, timid soul, sits upstage while the director is arguing with the leading lady downstage. And I had a box of groceries, which I was carrying at the time, and there was a banana in there. And I said to Michael, I promise I won't pull focus, but just so I'm not sort of sitting, being a lump, could I eat the banana? Yes, of course, he said. So I would carefully peel the banana every night and eat it. 8 performances a week for 8 months. For years after that, I couldn't face a banana without wanting to throw up.
The only director also, I think, to win directing Tony Awards for Kiss Me, Kate musical.
And Copenhagen in the same year. Yeah. 2 Tony Awards, 1 for drama, 1 for musical. Yeah. Astonishing. Yeah. He was a great, great director and a dear man.
You worked with him also in London.
On Don's Party, yes, the Royal Court, which is terrific. That had a great cast, and it was very. I loved the play. Those days, I was at my muscular peak, was in my obsession with the gym. And he wanted me to play the heavy in it, the one who beats people up. And I said, I want to play the terrible, weak, pipe-smoking wine taster in the suit.
Simon,
that's right. I played a lot of Simons when I was in London. Lots of bowler hats and umbrellas. And the wonderful description of it is when the character comes in and looks at me and says, who's the poofter with the poker up his ass? Well, it's a perfect description of Simon. But that was a joy to play. And eventually he agreed that I should play that part. And it worked very well for me. And it was a joy. I've remained friendly with one member of the cast, Barbara Ewing, a New Zealand actress who was well established in London by this time. And she now is a very celebrated historical novelist. And we see her every time we're in London, and she's been out to visit us in LA and to stay with us. But it's nice to retain those friendships of people that you do value.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's great to remember some of those people that we've lost.
Yeah.
Speaking of novelists, though, I know another novelist. Yes. So in LA, you really sort of embrace the writing career, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. Well, it not only does it keep up my typing skills, but as I said, always, it's like masturbation. You don't have to look your best to write. But I enjoy it now more than anything. I've always written. I've always wanted to write, as well as everything else. I think I've covered just about every facet of this business during the long time I've been in it. In my teens, before I really knew there was a theatre movement in Brisbane, I was fascinated by radio plays, obviously, and I bought some to read them. I bought them at the bookstore to see how they were laid out. And I wrote a very derivative radio play, a half-hour radio play, when I was about 17, before it was in theatre at all, and sent it to the ABC, I think it was, and the producer of many radio plays, I didn't put my age on it, wrote back and said, this is very interesting, but the subject is so derivative. Let us have something of a more original, whatever it was. But it was very encouraging. I never did write anything else, because then I became interested in acting, and that sort of wiped out any other interest I had. But when I was at the music hall, I wrote two shows for them. I did a very broad adaptation of Lady Audley's Secret, which has no villain. It's celebrated for being the first melodrama with a lady villain. So I wrote her as a heroine and wrote the villain in for myself, of course. And that ran for a year at the music hall and was done again in Melbourne. Then a couple of years later, I wrote a parody of westerns, television westerns, called How the West Was Lost, which Nolene did. And I left that to do the Bramston show. So there were two shows there. Acting then took over until Bramston. I wrote a few sketches. Mostly I composed music for Bramston. And then when I got to London, and during the years I was there, when the money ran out and I had a very poverty-stricken year, I started writing again. And that's stuck with me ever since. I wrote that farce for Ray. When I came back to Australia, I wrote for Carson's Law for 2 years. I wrote a lot of episodes for Carson's Law. And then I wrote Double Act, of course, for the ensemble, which has now been done in 25 languages or more. It's still on somewhere in the world. It's amazing. So it's an obsession now. And now, of course, the novels. And they started because first two novels I wrote, young adult novels, which were published by Random House, because we'd been to Pomfort and I'd been to Pompeii, and lots of stray dogs in Pompeii. I mean, wonderful, dusty mutts that are very friendly. People found that if they sent them to the pound, if they wanted to get rid of a dog, they would put the dog down. So rather than do that, they would leave them in the ruins of Pompeii, and the guards and the tourists would feed them, so they're happy. So Vaughan suggested the title was a great title, The Dogs of Pompeii, and we wrote this young adult novel called The Dogs of Pompeii, and then a sequel to it. Then I wrote a parody of film noir called Murder is Fatal, which was very well reviewed, had film interest, but which I never trust, without a grain of salt handy. And now it's all I'm doing. I'm writing novels. I've written two in the last 2 years, one of which was nominated for the annual Goodreads Award in the United States. It has some of the most remarkable reviews I've ever had. Most of them glowing about the characters, the development, the structure of the plot, how moving it was and all of that. But my favorite was from an 18-year-old girl in Canada called Nora, who just wrote, "Holy shit, this was good." Best review I've ever had. Now I'm working on, of course, more novels, which I enjoy enormously.
The novel, of course, is that there's a longer arc for the story. It's not your sketch writing, which is over in 2 minutes, perhaps. It's not your play, yes, which is over in 2 hours.
Yes.
You are captivating a reader for a greater length of time.
But you also are able to do something you can't do in a play. You can tell the audience what the character is thinking.
Yes.
And you can't do that in a play or a sketch. And the other thing that I've found has held me in good stead is my passion for structure. I think structure is everything. Even if it's a review sketch or a wisecrack, if the structure is wrong, it doesn't work. Same with a play. Even if a play is done in one act or two acts, there is still a three-act structure within that play. And the same is for a novel. Three acts. It's always got to be three.
So is the novel writing more liberating for you, do you think?
I'm not an addicted person, but I am obsessive when it comes to writing. I find that once I start, first of all, unlike my chum Barbara Ewing in London with the historical novels, we differ in our approach to how we write. I always have to know the end before I start the beginning. I wrote the final scene of Double Act before I wrote the first.
Right.
I have to know the tag of a sketch before I begin the sketch. A novel, I have to know exactly where it's going before I begin, because even if you've got the whole plot in your mind, if you don't know how it's going to end, you haven't got a novel. I think the best example of that was when I was living in New York. One of my great friends was a wonderful woman called Diane Trulock, who was a very powerful stage manager. And very often when she was doing a show on Broadway, I would go uptown late at night, meet her after the show, and we'd go to supper. And I was waiting at the stage door one night for her, and this crusty old doorman on the theatre, who'd been there for 100 years, said to me, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a writer." He said, "Everyone in New York's a writer." I said, "Really?" He said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Ask any taxi driver, how's the play coming? He'll tell you I'm having trouble with the second act." So always know where you're going, I think. Noel Coward did. Saint-Saëns, the composer, did. He could write a symphony in less than a week because he knew exactly, it was in his head before he started. The hard work is getting it down on paper exactly as you want it. And then the even harder work is when the editor, the publisher, gets hold of it, and you have to read the thing 20 goddamn times to take out all the errors and adjust the parrot, whatever. That's the tough part, having to read it over and over. But somebody said about writing novels, I can't remember his name now, said, "Writing a novel is like telling a joke and waiting for 2 years to see if anyone laughs."
Yeah. You've just released Zorro.
Yes, I did. That was a joy.
A very Hollywood story, Zorro.
Very Hollywood. But you know, it happened because... it's a long story. Do you want to hear the long story?
I love a long story.
Okay. Very famous audio producer here called Yuri Rosovsky, is well known throughout the country, did big cast audio productions, which were mostly put on CDs or broadcast on radio. And he did his own adaptation of the Zorro stories called The Mark of Zorro, big cast of 20 people, and Val Kilmer starred as Zorro. Big success. It was a wonderful success. I had done several audio productions for another company, and I had a phone call from Yuri Rosovsky inviting me over, and his first words to me were, "I'm dying," which he was. "I'm from cancer." And he said, "I want you to take over the adaptation of the sequel to Zorro and direct it, and whatever else I've got on my books after that." And in order to show me how he worked, he asked me to play a part in a wonderful spoof of Snow White that he did. And he said, "You play any part you want." And I said, "I want to play the husband that's rendered insensible by the evil Duchess," which was played by Kate Burton, who was a friend of mine anyway. And I had a great time doing that. The recordings were done in separate booths of 6 microphones, each audio track, each actor was on a separate track. Unlike the old days of radio where you all stood around one microphone and tried not to shuffle the script. Then the process went that you would go then into a Foley studio and record people walking, tearing paper, undoing buttons, zippers, knocking on doors, whatever. Then after that, back to the music and put the music track on it, and then the sound effects, and then put it all together in a studio, which it's a process that took months to do. So the week after we did the audio tracks, the voice tracks, he said, meet me in the Foley studio at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. I arrived at 8 o'clock. There was no sign of him. 9 o'clock, his wife called and said he's in the hospital and he won't last the day. So I was stuck suddenly with the entire post-production of this, and it was a learning curve. It was wonderful. So then the company said, what about the sequel to Zorro? And I read a bunch of the original novels, the 1919 novels by Johnston McCulley, and got the style into my head. And then the research, the period, 1807, which they take place, and the politics of Los Angeles, the politics of California, which was still Spanish at that time, and wrote this sequel called The Vengeance of Zorro. We got Val Kilmer on board, got the cast of 20. 6 months, Val Kilmer dicked us around. I'm busy, I can't do it, yes I can do it, no I can't do it. And a week before we had the studio booked and all of the actors booked, Val Kilmer dropped out completely. So the script went onto a shelf. The Zorro estate people read it and said, how about a novel? So there I was able to put this script, which didn't thankfully go to waste, into a novel, which I absolutely loved doing. It's you know, we all love Zorro. We've all seen the movies and the television shows and everything, so it was a joy to do. So that's just been published. That came out on my birthday last year, just a couple of weeks ago.
So you went from a script to the novel there. Have you gone the other way? Have you adapted any of your novels into a screenplay?
No, I haven't, but it could happen.
Yeah, right, good.
Particularly with the last one I did for Nine Star Publishers, which was called Phoenix, because it takes place in Phoenix, Arizona. It's a thriller, and that's had movie interest, so we'll be discussing that.
Yeah.
The movie business. Theatre is ordered and sane by comparison to the movie business. You get there at a certain time, the curtain goes up at a certain time, you go home at a certain time. The movies could take years to put it to motion, and I don't know if I've got those years to waste. I have no talent for pitching stories. I had no talent. It is a talent. If you can go into a boardroom full of executives and do the whole story in 10 minutes, which is what they want, they're very short attention span.
Yeah.
Last time I did that was for Double Act, when they thought that might be a movie. And I was in New York in the boardroom, and my producer friend said, keep it short, they won't listen longer than 10 minutes. It took me 2 hours to pitch the story. I didn't want to leave anything out.
Yeah.
They were dropping like flies at the end of this.
Anyone who loves the business, though, would love your novel, Murder is Fatal, which is a whole send-up of the noir.
The noir, but a very affectionate one.
Yeah.
It's some guy, a very naive guy, is accused of a murder and then has to chase down the real killers. But I referenced 100 movies in that. There's a line or a scene, a parody of a scene, from 100 movies throughout the novel. That was a joy to do. I loved that.
It's been an extensive life.
You can say that again.
What about the memoir? Is there a memoir in
there? There's a memoir. I did one last year at the behest of Nolene, mostly, said, when are you going to do it? And I finally buckled down and did it. There's not much interest in theatre memoirs in Australia, but I've had a request to do an audio book of it, which might happen, might not. But it was nice to get down parts of my life that I hadn't really thought about recently. It was nice to regurgitate them and put them all onto the machine and think, you know, this is my life.
Well, it's a bit cliched, but was it cathartic? Did you work through some things?
Yes. Some things still stick in my craw. I did not have a good relationship with my mother, of course. She tried actively to prevent me from going into theatre at all. That I had to cover. There are certain... let me tell you what I said in the preface. It says everything. I said, some names have been changed to protect the innocent. Others have been stated clearly to expose the motherfuckers.
Straight to the point.
Yes.
Barry, thank you. It's great to catch up again. Lots of folk in Australia and around the world will cherish listening to this and what you're up to. So thanks for filling us in.
Come back to LA.
For more details about any of Barry's work that you have heard spoken about in this episode, do check out his website, barry-creighton.com. That's Barry-creighton, C-R-E-Y-T-O-N.com. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed seeing Barry once more. He is indeed a polymath of all things art and entertainment. I'm Peter Ryers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.